Welcome back. The next case is United States v. Cooper. Because of the certified issue in this case, the court has determined that it is appropriate for the government to argue first in this matter. Major Friedewald, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Lieutenant Commander Wester, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Major Friedewald.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Efron, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Major Carrie Friedewald, and along with Mr. Brian Keller, I represent the United States. Chief Judge, if I could reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
The lower court abused its discretion in its application of Chin in two ways. First, by applying it as a prerequisite to considering the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and second, by applying it based on considerations outside the entire record. This court should vacate the lower court's opinion and remand for further Article 66 review of the remaining issues, including review of the granted issues. To the first point, the courts of criminal appeals have a unique statutory mandate. They must first find that findings are correct in law and fact, and then may determine if they determine on the basis of the entire record if they should be approved. This court held in Chin that that should be approved mandate requires the CCA to assess the entire record to determine whether to leave an accused waiver intact or to correct the error. This court, in its first review of this case, held that appellant waived the right to individual military counsel. Nothing in this court's opinion supports that that waiver also waived his right to raise the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel for his counsel's deficient performance in failing to route the IMC request.
We said in the first paragraph or the second paragraph of that opinion that that IAC claim was mooted, but you say in your reply brief quite clearly that it's not mooted. And was that just a mistake in our opinion?
No, Your Honor. The government reads the opinion as the claim being mooted as far as this court's review goes, but that it still remained one of the outstanding assignments of error for the lower court to address, and that it could address that claim directly under Strickland. That's how the government views this court's opinion.
And if that's the case, then when the CCA did not view it that way, and they seem to have viewed that the only way they could get to the IAC claim was to go through Chin. But it seems like your position is they could have just reviewed the IAC claim directly. They didn't need to go through Chin. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor, and it was a misapplication to go through Chin because Chin allows the CCA to look past the direct waiver of the legal issue to address the legal issue. Here the waiver was the right to IMC, though based on the government's view of the case as it stood on remand, there was no waiver of the IAC claim, so Chin simply had no role to play.
So if we agree with you, though, since you haven't certified an issue with respect to what the CCA did with the IAC claim, don't we just affirm? Don't we just simply say, well, we agree they shouldn't have used Chin. They could have gone directly to IAC, and they did review the IAC claim, and the government hasn't challenged it on appeal, so why don't we just affirm in that case?
Your Honor, the government's position is that this court would not be able to affirm the entire opinion, even if it agreed that the court misapplied Chin. And that's because the misapplication of Chin was more than just disregarding the wrong waiver, a waiver of IAC that did not exist. The way they applied Chin was not to address an underlying legal error. They applied Chin to remove the fact of appellant's waiver from their consideration under the Strickland prongs. And as cases like Garza show, when there is an appellant's waiver, an interplay between that appellant's trial waiver and their claim of IAC on appeal, the court must assess the impact of that waiver under the prongs of Strickland. In Garza, there was an appeal waiver when the appellant pled guilty at trial and a post-trial deficient performance of his counsel in failing to file the notice of appeal. Here, we have a pre-trial deficient performance of counsel when she failed to route the IMC request. So while appellant's not barred from complaining of that deficient performance, he did, subsequent to that deficient performance, personally, knowingly, and voluntarily waive the right to individual military counsel. So that waiver must be considered when analyzing whether he suffered any prejudice. This court held that when he voluntarily waived the right to IMC, then there was no deprivation of the statutory right to IMC at trial. So if there's a relevant period to be analyzed under IAC, it's that pretrial period leading up to his waiver.
Is that within the scope of the certified issue? Because you didn't certify the any question regarding how the Strickland was done. But I guess what you're saying is, well, it's all part and parcel of the Chin analysis.
Exactly, Your Honor. It is all part and parcel. We did not certify it as a discrete issue, but the government's view is that it is part and parcel and that it's not just the prefatory paragraphs of the lower court's opinion that are incorrect. It inextricably infected how they applied Strickland. And the government believes that that's within the certified issue.
Peter, there's lots of moving parts in this case. First off, if I could, I'd like to address this Chin issue, whether the CCA should have gone through Chin or should have gone through our opinion in Cooper 1. It seems to me, in essence, what the CCA was saying is the IAC issue and the IMC issue were inextricably linked, and that through waiver, those issues were extinguished. And I think using the term extinguished kind of clarifies the point here of what the CCA was trying to get at. It seemed as if their feeling was the only way to revive both the IAC and the IMC claim is to go through Chin. Why were they mistaken in that approach?
Your Honor, they were mistaken because that's simply not how the Chin court found that the ability to disregard waiver would apply. In Chin, the holding said that the CCAs must determine whether to leave an accused waiver intact or to correct the error. In cases like Chin, where the UMC error was on the face of the record itself, or errors such as multiplicity or pretrial confinement credit that might be evident on the record itself, those are evident underlying errors that a direct waiver could be cut through to get at to fix. Here, they circuitously used Chin to circuitously remove from the record, excised from the record his waiver so that they would not need to deal with this fact of his waiver when applying Strickland and assessing for ineffective assistance of counsel. That, in the government's view, is the unfettered approach to Chin and this ability to disregard waiver, where they're using it to shape the record.
But in Chin, where did this court say that a CCA is required to identify the legal standard or legal rationale for disregarding waiver?
Your Honor, I agree that it's not that the CCA needs to point to a legal rationale for disregarding the waiver. This court in NIRAD held that once a waiver is disregarded, the CCA must disapprove a finding based on a legal test subject to appellate review. So when they disregarded the waiver here, they were shaping the way they were applying that legal test, not disregarding a waiver to get to the direct underlying error, Your Honor.
Now, the CCA, in its opinion, explicitly stated, we are bound by this determination of waiver. So you're saying that they were articulating that, but they weren't actually operationalizing that.
Exactly, Your Honor. They paid lip service to this court's holding that it was a waiver, and yet nonetheless chose to disregard the waiver on facts like an accused's trepidation to tell the military judge their true feelings on their rights to counsel, which this court explicitly held is the purpose of that colloquy. That's the exact time that an accused does that.
So what? I, when I read Chin, all it says to me is that the CCA, in its broad plenary review of the record, if it spots any legal error that it sees in the record, even if it's been waived, it can address it. It can consider it. And so why do they need a variance? They reviewed the record. They think they see a legal error. They cite Chin. They say we have the CAF told us we can do this. We're going to do it. And then they change gears and consider the issue. I don't understand what the misapplication of Chin is. Now, if you're saying, like, that was all fine, they can do that. But when they then go and apply, when they consider the issue, they can't infect that analysis with the, you know, with ignoring the waiver, because the waiver is still important in the IEC claim. That, okay, that's a different argument, but I feel like you're conflating these two things. Once, you know, the first is, could they look at the record, spot a legal error, and fix it? And I read Chin to say they can, and it suggests that you think they misapplied Chin somehow. But then, having done that in the second half of their opinion, when they consider the IMC, IAC, whatever you want to call it, you're saying they're using Chin to affect that analysis. That's sort of a different argument. So are you making the first argument that they misapplied Chin in some fashion, or are you only making the second argument that when they considered the legal error that they intended to fix, that they infected it with things that they shouldn't have done based on Chin?
Your Honor, I see those as almost being one and the same, Your Honor. We agree with you that the Chin holding does allow, I agree with your reading of Chin. It allows the CCA to spot a legal error and fix it even if it's waived. But that's not what was done here. The IAC claim was not waived. Appellants, the fact that appellant waived the right is a matter to be considered under Strickland. So the way they misapplied Chin here was by removing a portion of the record to apply, and then to apply the legal standard to the separate legal issue of IAC. So if anything is conflated, Your Honor, it was the lower court conflating the statutory right to IMC, which is waivable and was waived here, and the Sixth Amendment right to the assistance of counsel, which this court held in Gooch, is not waived by an appellant's waiver where that waiver was based on the performance he asserts was deficient. So there was simply no waiver preventing the lower court from reviewing the IAC claim. So Chin had no role to play in how they addressed the IAC claim. So where they misapplied Chin was to remove appellant's waiver and review the record absent a fact integral to assessing the Strickland claim, Your Honor. And so they took an assignment of error that was before them. In the government's view, that was before them, and shaped the record in the way they wanted to review it by using Chin.
Now, I understand your point, and that may be the better way to approach this. The question that we have is that the only way to approach it? So here we've got Chin that provides very broad authority to the CCA, which then shifts us into NERAD, which provides very broad authority to the CCA. So the question is, why was the CCA compelled, required, to take your approach rather than say, essentially, I'm getting it down to its bottom line, in Chin, we've got this broad authority to disregard waiver. Once we do that, we look at our Article 66C authority. It's very broad, as defined by NERAD, and we're pointing to a legal standard here for why we think it should not be approved. And so we at this level should say, this is the authority that we have given to the CCAs, but more importantly, the authority that has been provided under 66C.
Your Honor, I see Chin as an extension of NERAD, not as two separate abilities. In NERAD, the court said that absent the should-be-approved language, doctrines such as waiver would prevent the CCA from correcting errors. So Chin simply more explicitly directed CCAs to look at every waiver, whether that's something a waiver of an error that goes to findings or sentence or something else. So I don't think they work hand in hand. I don't see them being as two separate avenues of reviewing 66. So the ability to disregard the waiver resides in that should be approved, that discretionary third prong of what this court has described as the three constraints resident in Article 66, where a CCA turns directly to its should, discretionary should-be-approved authority before determining whether the findings and sentence are otherwise correct in law and fact. They're prioritizing that discretionary authority over their authority as a court of law to determine, based on any asserted legal or factual errors, whether the findings and sentence are able to be affirmed. In the government's view, the lower court ignored other outstanding legal errors that were not waived, that were before the court, and then later in supplemental filings ignored a preserved issue that's the subject of the granted issues now in order to prioritize their ability to provide discretionary relief under that should-be-approved prong. The government is concerned with this approach in general because of its prioritization of that discretionary ability. And, Your Honor, another way to look at this, perhaps, is that this type of waiver is really where the limits of Chin might end, where we have a waiver, and Chief Judge Olson in Cooper 1, an argument at this court, you noted that this type of colloquy is different. It's personal between the military judge and the accused. There's no interlocutor. A waiver that results from this personal inquiry is categorically different from a waiver through trial defense counsel where they say, I have no objection to the findings instructions. So perhaps Chin reaches its limits when we get to a waiver like this, this personal waiver that maybe does actually extinguish the error. Because this court's holding, it follows from this court's holding that when he voluntarily and personally waived the right to IMC, he was not thereafter deprived of his statutory right to IMC at trial because he went to trial with the counsel he asked to be represented by. So perhaps there are waivers like this that truly are outside the limits of Chin and that a CCA cannot, through their should-be-approved powers, revive because the waiver truly does serve to extinguish the error. And to the government's second point about the court's abuse of discretion here.
But to be clear, that would be a new rule. There's nothing in Chin that suggests what you're asking for.
There's not, Your Honor. That would be a new rule. Yes, Your Honor. To the government's second point about the abuse of discretion here, and this second category of abuse of discretion would reach to the entire opinion as well and require this court to set aside the entire opinion and not merely kind of the prefatory introduction. And that was that the lower court based its decision to exercise its discretion on considerations outside the entire record. Article 66 itself, and as Chin highlighted, said that these determinations must be based on an assessment of the entire record. Instead, the lower court here adopted a unique military circumstances test and said that it was disregarding appellant's waiver based on the need to highlight the importance to the right of military counsel.
Now, to be fair, was the CCA really saying it's a test, or are they simply saying this is a particularly firm ground or firm instance when we can do this? That seemed to be what the CCA, to me, was saying.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that, Your Honor. The point is that, and as the dissent at the lower court noted, the majority didn't point to anything specific in appellant's record or an appellant's case that called out for review. They did it for these outside reasons, like highlighting the importance, ensuring that trial defense counsel across the Navy and Marine Corps are adhering to these requests.
What difference does any of that make? We gave them this broad power, and they exercised it. We didn't put any limitation on when they can exercise it other than they can't do it for equity reasons. And they spotted a legal error, and they said, we're going to address it. And then they gave explanations why they thought it was appropriate in this circumstance to exercise this broad power that they have. But I don't know what difference does it make what reasons they gave. We didn't put any limitations other than the equity limitations on their power, and they were just explaining why they thought it necessary in this particular instance to do it. What's wrong with that?
Your Honor, it's wrong because 66 itself says it must be on a determination of the entire record. Every other exercise of that should be approved discretion, whether it's the UMC test, relief for post-trial delay, it's based on an individual assessment of that appellant's record and whether that appellant's record warrants this discretionary relief, not whether the issue globally needs to be addressed or highlighted. That would, in the government's view, put an equity spin on the exercise if they merely wanted to use this as a test case to warn the fleet about the dangers of not honoring an IMC request, when in fact they never determined that this appellant needed this discretionary relief. The lower court,
I mean, they found he was prejudiced, and they found that his counsel's performance was deficient. It seems like they had a good reason.
Your Honor, they did, but the prejudice they found was limited to pretrial prejudice. Appellant went to trial with the counsel he wanted to be represented by. The lower court has twice.
I don't know if that's exactly a fair characterization of what happened. He asked for someone else. He didn't get him. He got somebody else. He was satisfied with that because he was told the person he wanted wasn't available. I wouldn't exactly characterize that as going to trial with the counsel you wanted.
Well, I certainly note your point, Your Honor, but my point in response is that the lower court has twice refused to look at the performance of his detailed counsel at trial to determine if, in exercising their discretionary authority, this case called out for that relief. And the dissent at the lower court noted that they gave no personalized reasons for why he required this relief here.
So with this whole NEARAD analysis, you're saying that a CCA has to explain to us all of their reasoning all the way through?
No, Your Honor. And in fact, many CCAs, when they discuss the Chin ability and whether or not they're going to disregard waiver, they simply say, we have decided after reviewing the appellant's record that we will not exercise our ability to disregard waiver. That there's nothing wrong with that. They don't have to go into more detail than that, as long as they're not looking at considerations outside the record. What the lower court did here was like what the error of the lower court in Hutchison, where they made a sentence appropriateness analysis, not based on the appropriateness of his military sentence, but because perhaps they disagreed with his state civilian conviction. This is analogous to that, Your Honor, where they stepped outside their statutory mandate in 66. We look into things outside the individualized appellant's record and when exercising their discretionary.
But why under NEARAD couldn't they simply cite the legal standard of the accused here was entitled to IMC, look at it through that prism?
Well, Your Honor, in that case then, this is analogous to the error the lower court made in NEARAD, where in NEARAD the lower court said we don't think this conduct should be criminalized. Here they're saying we don't like that he waived his right to IMC.
I don't think that's what they're saying. What they're saying is that he had a right to IMC and the counsel failed to forward the request. So that's a different facet of this, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor. And that, well, again, brings me back to the first abuse of discretion, that they shaped the way they were going to apply the Strickland analysis by removing the fact of appellant's waiver from their consideration, which is not how the government reads Chin to operate.
Counsel, could you identify in the opinion where they expressly said that they were not going to consider waiver as part of the Strickland analysis? That would be helpful.
Your Honor, I'll acknowledge that they don't explicitly say that. The lead-up to the Strickland test, they say, we are disregarding waiver and now we will proceed to Strickland, and then they fail to talk about his waiver.
Okay, so it was something that they didn't discuss in the opinion rather than an affirmative, we don't think that the waiver applies to our consideration of IAC.
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree, and that's why the government believes they used it to remove a fact from the consideration rather than grappling with how it affects the Strickland prongs.
I'm trying to figure out why we would be convinced that they removed this from their consideration, and that they've discussed disregarding waiver because they can't rely on waiver to simply make the case go away. When this court remanded the case to the CCA, it said, now you've got to take a look at all the other issues, one of which was IAC. And my question is, does the language in which they talk about disregarding the waiver do anything more than saying, as a result of the decision from the Court of Appeals of the Armed Forces, we have to disregard waiver now if we're going to consider IAC.
I agree, Your Honor.
As opposed to saying, oh, when we're considering IAC, we won't take waiver into account.
I agree, Your Honor, that is a way to read the lower court's opinion. That gets to our point that there was no need, there was no waiver of IAC, and there was no need to they did not need to exercise Chin to disregard any waiver to get to the IAC claim, Your Honor. And in the time remaining, I'll turn to the granted issues.
Before you do that, since we're on this topic, I'd just like to ask Judge Sparks whether he has any questions.
I do not. Thank you.
Please proceed, Major Friedel.
So the government's position is that should the court find the certified issue in the government's favor, there are other outstanding errors still for the CCA to address, and so the granted issues should be remanded for those to be addressed by the CCA in the first instance. In cases like Riley, Johnson, and Mitchell, there is this court's precedent seems to favor the CCA addressing issues in the first instance. As we noted in our brief, the issue is before the court, so the court could in its discretion, choose to address the issue as well. If the court chooses to address the merits of the granted issue, it should find that the military judge did not abuse his discretion in denying renewed closing argument. This case is qualitatively and quantitatively different from Bess. Qualitatively, the evidence at issue in Bess, the muster reports, went directly to the central issue in the case, the identity of the perpetrator, and they were damning on their face. Here, while the victim's credibility was certainly a central issue to the case, the answer the members received in no way affected or detracted from her credibility. It simply did not pose that she had any motive to fabricate. So it was qualitatively unlike the evidence at issue in Bess. The case is quantitatively different from Bess because in Bess there were kind of three tiers of infringement on his right to present a defense, to confront the foundational witness for the muster reports, to put on his own rebuttal witness, and to present closing argument. Here, appellant asked to reopen closing argument on a single point of evidence. And as I noted, that point of evidence was inconsequential in the full context of the trial. So while the military judge in Bess, on those facts, Your Honor, if I could conclude.
Please conclude.
On those facts, the military judge fell outside the reasonable range of options. The military judge here, even though the judges of this court might have taken a more conservative approach and allowed argument, the judge here did not abuse his discretion. It was not outside the reasonable range of choices. Thank you, Your Honor.
Lieutenant Commander Wester.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Efren, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Commander Michael Wester, and I represent YN2 Cooper. This court should answer the certified question in the negative because lower court properly applied United States versus Chin. Regardless, this court should affirm the lower court's judgment because the military judge constitutionally erred when he prevented defense counsel from presenting a closing argument on all of the evidence in this case. As to the Chin argument, there is only one narrow question to be answered in response to Judge Maggs's question to the government, and that's the one that was certified, whether the lower court was permitted to look past the waiver itself. Getting into Strickland, getting into did they take the waiver, did they properly factor that into the second prong, is for this purpose of this appeal beside the point. And so that's just a primary principle here. And time and again, this court has said the answer to the question is, yes, the lower court can do this. In Chin itself, this court cited, by my count, three decades of precedent, six different opinions in which this court reaffirmed the principle that a CCA is not bound by ordinary rules of waiver in the exercise of its Article 66C statutory grant. The words in NERAD, as this court explained, should be approved, are not to be construed as mere surplusage. They're also not the third part of a sequential test, as the government posits. The structure of the statute itself is just a limitation on a CCA's ability to affirm. It's different categorically from Article 59A in that sense, which limits the court's ability to reverse. And so in Tardif, I think the point is clearly made. It's even if prongs one and two are met, the court may still look to the third prong of should be approved. even if, in, is another way of saying regardless, the court may, even if so, so, and if it's regardless, it's okay. Well, we can go to the third power before the first two. And that's, even by the, even on the government's logic here, it sounds like they're faulting the CCA for doing just that, which this court has said repeatedly it can do. So, to answer another question that was asked, no, there's no legal requirement about how to look past waiver itself. In Quiroz, Senior Judge Efferin wrote that its CCA was well within its power to, well within its discretion to determine when to exercise that discretion to look past waiver. Nirad says the court has the plenary authority always, actually a requirement to look at the entire record, and has the plenary authority to decide whether to look past it. The issue about when a legal standard is required deals with an issue that's just not certified, and that's when they disapprove the finding. They can't do it with regard to equity. That was the problem in Nirad, where, you know, the CCA basically said, got it, but they shouldn't have charged us in the first place. And that's clearly not what's happening here. The lower court is acknowledging that this court determined that appellant waived this issue and in no way indicated that it wasn't paying respect to that holding. To the contrary, it was noting the fact that it may look past that waiver to address issues such as the ones that it did, ineffective assistance of counsel.
Is it apparent from the opinion why the court did not rely on the legal standards for ineffective assistance of counsel, but instead relied on its unique Article 66?
I think Senior Judge Efferin, the answer to that is that the lower court determined that this court's opinion had determined that issue moot. Because so this is another confusion. The certified issues in the prior appeal to this court were, one, was the issue waived, and then, two, does Strickland apply under IAC principles? And it seems like the government is now saying that wasn't the certified issue, or at least that was not really what the certified issue was. But that's, I think, a misreading. I think the second certified issue in the prior case said, you know, does Strickland apply? And this court had determined that question was moot. And mootness, of course, means it's academic at this point. So
is that correct, though? We said that in our first paragraph. Then later on in the opinion, we didn't mention it. And in the decretal paragraph, we don't mention it. In the first paragraph, we said it was mooted. But it, and I joined that opinion, but it doesn't seem like it's logically mooted. And I'm concerned that we said something, that it was mooted, when that wasn't correct. And that confused the CCA, and that's why they did the whole Chin analysis rather than just decide the issue straight up.
Your Honor, let's assume for the sake of argument that this court erred in saying that the issue is moot, or at least the lower court misinterpreted this court. I mean, we'd be in the same place. There's no sequential test, so the lower court is still free to use the should-be-approved power. And it seems like the government's position is a little bit on board with this, too. I mean, they say on page 6 of their reply, but in its Strickland analysis, the lower court fails to consider that he unequivocally, directly, and without the filter of his defense counsel, waived the right. And then in the prior appeal to this court, I know this is not within our briefing here, but it's before this court, the prior appeal, they say there wasn't any prejudice under the second Strickland prong. So I don't really know that question matters as it pertains to the court's authority to use its should-be-approved power. We'd be in the same place. Let's say they had to go 59A first. Okay, well, the 59A, according to the government's logic, would get the accused no relief. And so now we're, okay, so do we use the should-be-approved power? And so I think that would be the best response to that question, Your Honor, that it kind of is not necessary, first of all, to get into the ultimate issue before this court, which is whether they were allowed to use the power in the first place.
Does the first page of Cooper in the 2020 opinion in discussing mootness, does that necessarily mean that those issues are moot for all time? As opposed to meaning, well, we've got four issues in front of us here. We'll decide one. The others are moot for purposes of the litigation before our court today or that day. Is that clear from the opinion?
I read it as a legal term, Senior Judge Efferin. I mean, I you know, mootness obviously has, as you're well aware, independent legal meaning. And so in that sense, I mean, the government argued, again, in that opinion, its position was that there was no prejudice under Strickland. So perhaps that this court used that term for good reason. I mean, perhaps it was agreeing. I don't pretend to have the answer to that question about, you know, what this court was thinking when it used that term. But I would just, again, piggyback just on the answer to Judge Magnus' question that I don't know that it really matters. I mean, the question before this court is simply, can you look past the waiver itself? And that's certainly, no one disputes that this court determined that it was a waiver. And as it relates to the issue before us, it's the answer is yes, they can look past it, regardless of what the term moot may have meant in the prior opinion. Now, there was discussion about...
Can I ask just one question? If we agree with you on this point that, look, it doesn't really matter, because even if the government is correct that they could have just gone directly to Strickland, and even if the government's correct that if they had just gone to Strickland and hadn't been affected by Gin, and they had found that there was no ineffective assistance of counsel, they then could have gone directly, they could have gone to Gin, and they would have come to the same result. And as a result, we should just affirm. Is that your position?
Effectively, yes, Your Honor. That is my position. As this court explained in NIRAD, I mean, the should be approved power gives a CCA authority to disapprove even legally correct findings. And so that again underscores, in my view, the illogic in the view of saying, well, you know, the 59A needs to be gotten at first. Well, if that's a requirement, that would almost seem to swallow what this court is saying about, you know, the more encompassing power that the should be approved power is. And so, yes, Your Honor, I mean, even if, as a matter of law, there was no ineffective assistance of counsel had they applied the Strickland analysis, we would be in the same place in this appeal. There was discussion about, did they go outside the record in talking about the circumstances in which the IMC, you know, why it was, essentially, they were applying, disregarding Chin in this case. And I think that rather than going outside of the record, this court is actually cabining, or at least suggesting strongly that it's not just going to willy-nilly look past waiver here. It's looking specific. What are we talking about? We're talking about what happened in this case. You know, the appellant's trial defense counsel did not forward the IMC request. No one disputes that. And as a result, he didn't get the IMC that he requested. And so the lower court is saying, well, the IMC is a unique military right. Looking to United States versus Conley in the Army Court of Criminal Appeals interpretation of when it might look past waiver, it's saying, well, yeah, we kind of agree with that. It's an important military circumstance. You know, we're an appellate court, but we're also uniformed officers. It might undermine good order and discipline if we as a uniformed court were to say, you know, I got it. He did ask for this counsel, but you know what? It's too bad. I think that's what they were doing there. They were saying, you know, without saying perhaps affirmatively, that when they're going to use this power, they're only going to do it in circumstances like this that apply uniquely in this case. So I don't think there's any support to the idea that they're going outside of waiver. And there was a comparison about Hutchison. Well, Hutchison was the case in which the CCA, in exercising its sentence appropriateness review, did something similar to NIRAD and said, well, the state shouldn't have tried him a second time, or excuse me, the military court shouldn't have tried him because he was already prosecuted out in town. And again, that's equity. I mean, that's not what's happening here. So the issues are just dissimilar, Your Honor.
So just to be clear in my mind, in terms of the NIRAD legal standard, in your brief you're saying it's IAC, but it almost seems now as if you're saying it's the IMC issue. So what is the legal standard, in your view, that put the CCA on firm ground in the NIRAD context?
IAC, Your Honor. So they're saying that, appellants, and the government doesn't dispute this. So, again, to kind of respond to two questions at once, it's that they're saying it's equity. Well, the government's conceding that under the first prong of Strickland that the lower court was correct. So I don't know how we can be saying that it's equity. And so directly to Your Honor's question, it's IAC, and both sides agree that the first prong was met. And I don't think there's any argument that at least in that sense the lower court wasn't applying a legal standard. And here the standard at play dealt with IMC, of course, because it implicated it. But, of course, you know, the overlapping issue that it occurred in, the framework, if you will, was Strickland, ineffective assistance of counsel. I wanted to respond to one more point. In the brief, the government talks about Vasquez. That was a case in which this court reversed because the lower court used terms like military due process. I think that, again, that doesn't have support here, but there's another reason why it doesn't have support. In Vasquez, the court was purporting to do that based on Article 59A. So it was kind of like two problems in one. You're referring to something that is not a legal concept, number one, but you're also doing it under the concept of Article 59A. And here we don't have either circumstance. If there are no further questions on Chin, I would like to talk about the issues this court granted review of.
Before you do that, Judge Sparks, do you have any questions?
No, Chief, thank you.
Please proceed.
So in Herring versus New York, the Supreme Court explained the principle that it's not until after all the evidence is in that counsel for the parties are in a position to, you know, present their respective versions of the case as a whole. And they say only then can they argue the inferences to be drawn from all the testimony. And that language, you know, even if it might be called dicta, I mean, it piggybacked on what the court had said in United States versus Bayer years earlier, where, you know, the court, again, explained, when you reopen a case and you don't allow the parties to present closing argument to close the gap on that or present their version of the case, what you're left with is a defect in the trial. And of course, that was the same concept this court discussed in United States versus Bess, where, you know, different in some sense because we dealt with, you know, a tangible piece of evidence that was admitted, but of course the same concept, which is we're allowing new evidence to be presented after the members have already begun their deliberative process, and we're also not allowing counsel to respond to that evidence. And so we believe this alone should warrant, affirming the lower court's judgment. We mentioned the cross-appeal doctrine. Of course, this court also granted review. But, you know, we're obviously entitled to defend the lower court's judgment on any basis supported. And so in this way, I believe, regardless of whether the lower court deemed it appropriate to consider the argument, it is an argument that supports doing exactly what the lower court did, albeit for different reasons. And so we don't believe a remand would be necessary, especially given where we're at, which is 7 years of appellate litigation following trial and, multiple remand. This would be a multiple remand situation. And on the issue of prejudice, the government, JA 464 talks, that's kind of the key. So this new testimony was not insignificant with respect to my colleague. For the first time, the members heard that, you know, she had spoken with somebody before she reports the allegation. And, of course, trial counsel in his closing said, who knew about it? Nobody did. Why would she lie about this? For JA 464, the person to whom she makes the report formally says that he had breakfast with her earlier that morning. This would have been hours after the incident. And saw nothing out of the ordinary with her demeanor and so forth. Of course, did not mention the incident. So what changed? Well, what changed is what she tells us. She spoke with this other sailor, and she began to explain that the sailor warned her if she did not report appellant, this would happen to other people. Not all of that specific point came out at trial, but she began to talk about it. Okay, so the defense stands up and says, Your Honor, we believe this warrants an argument now that there was a motive to fabricate. I mean, trial counsel just told the members the opposite. And the military judge, nope, you haven't convinced me yet. So that summary denial, I think, would not require this court to come up with a new rule. This court could simply explain, point to Bess, you know, when this court explained RCM 921 Bravo, allows great discretion to a judge to reopen the case after deliberations, but the procedures have to be employed to make sure that the trial itself does not, prejudice the parties. And we just admit that was not done here. There were a number of arguments that the defense could have made, and in a case where the evidence was, you know, as the lower court explained, just not overwhelming. You know, she was in the room voluntarily. There was no injury, no alcohol. She told this friend to whom she made the report, excuse me, not the friend, the sailor to whom she made the formal report, he testified that when he asked her what happened, that it was consensual. And then, you know, she changes that a little bit, but I think, again, that gets to the argument of, well, if with closing argument, the defense can explain. Yeah, well, that kind of shows that she was struggling. Was this an assault, or was this, do I feel like I was assaulted, or was this a regrettable incident that my friend is now kind of cajoling me to report? And so the fact that we're having this discussion shows the importance of advocacy on this point, especially in a very close case like this.
Counsel, can I ask a question about the judgment, which is that the CCA set aside the findings and sentence and authorized a rehearing. Would anything be different if we were to affirm based on the assigned issues as opposed to just rejecting the certified issue?
Nothing would be different. We're not asking for an expansion, Your Honor, and that would be improper under the cross-appeal doctrine, so we're not saying that. And so if this court were to apply the cross-appeal doctrine and affirm, we would be in the same place. We would be at with the lower court's opinion, which is that, you know, the signing of the sentence would be set aside, a rehearing would be authorized. And if there are no further questions, Your Honor, that would be our argument.
Judge Sparks, did you have any questions at this point?
No, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. Major Friedewald.
Two points. First, Judge Maggs, your point about whether this court's language in Cooper 1 led to confusion, I agree with you. I think it certainly could have. But the difference in language in mooted versus waiver, I think, is an interesting one to delve into, because this court did not say that the IAC claim was waived, which is how the lower court seemed to treat it, that they could only reach it by disregarding a waiver of that claim, but that claim wasn't waived. But if this court truly said that the IAC issue was mooted and meant more than just mooted for the terms of that case at this level, if it was truly mooted, I think that goes to the government's point that there are certain waivers that are outside the limits of Chin. Because if the issue is entirely mooted, that means that the error truly was extinguished with appellant's waiver. So even if the court believes that's the case, that it said that the issue was mooted writ large, that's different from it being waived. And I think that there are waivers outside the limits of Chin, and this personal knowing voluntary colloquy that's done for the right to counsel, it's done for forum choice, it's done for, you know, the guilty pleas, that those might be waivers, unless you can truly show that trial defense counsel really twisted their arm, somehow forced them to say that they wanted only them, or forced them to say what they wanted, that those waivers may truly be outside the limits of Chin.
But to remark upon Judge Hardy's comment, that would require us to rewrite Chin.
Not rewrite, Your Honor. It would be to cabin Chin. I don't think it would require a full rewriting of Chin, Your Honor.
It would require a significant revision of Chin.
It might, Your Honor, but I think it's worth exploring because of this idea that whether the issue at large was mooted, that's certainly different than whether it was waived. And to the second point I want to make is, Judge Maggs, you asked appellant or my colleague about if they could have applied Strickland law, found he couldn't be afforded relief, and then applied Chin directly to the waiver of IMC and then afford relief. That's where we run into this conceptual problem where the appellate fact-finding was done here to develop the IAC claim. So what are the limits then where a CCA can point to facts developed on appeal at a Dubé hearing where those are the very same facts that were waived development of at trial? So it almost leads to the conclusion that had there been no IAC claim for appropriate appellate fact-finding, can a CCA use its ability under Chin to disregard a waiver to develop the very facts that were waived development of at trial? So this is another reason why and Your Honor, if I could
briefly conclude, please.
Another reason why the conflation of the issues here and the posture of this case seems to put this waiver outside the limits of Chin, or at the very least, that the court misapplied Chin here. And the government would ask that this court vacate and remand.
Judge Sparks, do you have any questions?
No, I do not. Thank you.
Any other judges have any questions? All right, the case is now submitted. The court thanks both parties, and the court will stand in recess until further order of the court.